believe that's everyone. We're certainly welcome you to take this material and study it and bring it back tomorrow night, and we'll continue our study in this series through Friday night. Tonight we're studying lesson 3, so if you want to open the material to page 7, that's where we'll begin. I'm going to begin where we left off last night with the overhead projector charts that will allow us to summarize what we've covered so far very quickly and move on in the lesson tonight. We're going to try to manage our time tonight so that we are able to cover material sufficiently. We may not be able to cover it in its entirety, some of it less time than others, but if we get through the lesson and we're able to accomplish our objective of learning the basic principles of this lesson, we will have spent our time well. Let me turn the projector on just a moment. And this is charts that those who have been here in the first two classes have already seen, basically. But what we have seen in Lesson 1, the church promised. It was a part of God's eternal purpose. It was a part of prophecy. What we studied last night, that the church was established, and God reveals the specific point in time and place that the church was established. And what we have seen in looking at the prophecy and looking at the prophecy fulfilled is very important, that if in prophecy, in the Old Testament, God prophesied the eternal purpose, the church in his eternal purpose, to be, as Isaiah prophesied, a house, as Daniel, a kingdom, and as Zechariah, a temple. And if, in fact, we find that the church established upon the day of Pentecost, in Acts the 2nd chapter, is that very house, that very kingdom, and that very temple, then it is conclusively and exclusively, without question, the church in God's eternal purpose. And we can base our faith upon that and go to heaven because of our belief in him and his church and our faithfulness to it. Friday night will be a lesson where we will bring this down to a level of recognition today. But what I want to do is for us to then proceed from this, that the Church of Christ then is the fulfillment of prophecy. It wasn't the Roman Catholic Church. It did not fulfill Isaiah 2, Daniel 2, Zechariah 6, or any other prophecy. It wasn't Protestant churches that came out of the Reformation movement that fulfilled these prophecies. It was the Lord's Church. That needs to be understood by all religious people. And that it was established in 33 in the city of Jerusalem. And so we are led tonight to ask a question. Did the Lord leave his church in some kind of chaotic disarray after it was established? Did he leave it in disorganized confusion? All of us know the answer to that question. Absolutely not. Rather, the Lord organized his church, placed organization within the church that he bought with his blood and established upon the day of Pentecost. Here's the basic premise of our lesson tonight. Let me add this as we remove the top part of this. What we're doing is just simply noting that Christ has given his church organization. Now, again, that ought to impress our minds with the fact of how important it is to know when the church was established. You see, those who have the church being established some other time don't have the right organization. The organization came when the church was established. Let me insert something here that I think is important for all of us. These principles that we're talking about are principles that maybe a lot of us have experienced teaching. When we talk to people about the salvation of their soul, let me give you an example of an experience that I had not too long ago. I had the opportunity to talk with a young couple, a husband and wife, who were a member of a denominational church. And what we were trying to show them, the very principles that we've been studying, teaching these very things to them in their home, and then showing them from Acts the 2nd chapter when the Lord's church was established, and then I brought their attention to the church, the religious group that they happened to be members of. And I asked them, do you understand when this New Testament church was established? Yes. Acts 2, AD 33, city of Jerusalem. Do you realize when the church that you're a part of started? It started October 13th, 1908, in the state of Texas. They said, what? You see, they had never even thought about that. The Nazarene church, of which they were members, did not start until the beginning of this century in Texas. And they looked at that and would say, they began to think. And I'll tell you, as a result of that, they were converted to Christ. These are principles that are important in teaching others. And some we'll cover here further tonight will do the same. So if you have your material open to page 7, I want us to... I realize that what is on page 7 is to most familiar. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on this page. I think it's important. And because we might spend less time on it doesn't mean that what it teaches is we're trying to ignore or minimize in some way. But in order to understand the organization of Christ's church, the very foundation of that is the fact that he put himself as the supreme ruler of his church. He is exclusively the ruler of his church. Now, how do we know that? Well, I have under letter A how that can be seen and how completely the New Testament teaches that principle. Christ holds a preeminent position. That preeminent position is one of preeminent authority. And that can be seen as you look at the church as the kingdom. That teaches us its administrative nature. Administratively, the church is a monarchy. A monarchy is a rule by a king. The king is preeminent over his kingdom. And that's exactly what Jesus Christ is over the church. When you look at the church as a house, that emphasizes its family nature, a household nature. That's the meaning of that word. Well, in Hebrews, the third chapter in verse 6, the last passage we have indicated there, the Hebrew writer was comparing Christ with Moses. And his purpose was to show the superiority of Christ over Moses. And we'll read this passage to show what the Hebrew writer said in the third chapter and verse 6. After mentioning Moses, in the fifth verse, but Christ as a son over his house, whose house are we, if we hold fast our boldness and the glorying of our hope firm unto the end? Whose house are we? You see, so far as the dispensation was concerned, Moses was nothing but a servant in God's dispensation of the Mosaical law. But now in verse 6, to show the superiority of Christ, he says, but, see, in contrast, Christ as a son over his house. Whose house are we? Now, what does that teach us? It teaches that Christ has preeminence in the house of God. He is a son over the house of God. And so he is the ruling son. He holds preeminent position. Likewise, when you look at the church as the body, and all of us would be acquainted with the fact that it teaches the working nature of the church, but Christ's relationship to it is what? A head. There is no higher position in relationship to a body than the head. The head rules, the head directs, and that's Christ's relationship to it. This is the way that the New Testament teaches, in addition to other passages, the preeminent position that Christ holds. He is the supreme authority over his church. So when we look at organization, that must be recognized. No man shares that with him. He has not delegated that to any vicar today or any person who would be hold some kind of preeminent position over the church on the earth today. He is exclusively the preeminent ruler of his church. And he does that exclusively through the New Testament. That's what letter B is teaching. If you look at letter B, you see, the church which belongs to Christ accepts only the teaching of Christ. That must be. And That means then that the New Testament is the only standard of authority that we have. There is no other standard of authority. If we have the preeminent one giving us his authority in his teaching, then that teaching is our only authority. And we are not permitted to depart from it. Whosoever goeth onward and abideth not in the teaching of Christ hath not God. It's that simple. 2 John verse 9. Now, we have mentioned at the bottom what this does, and hopefully our religious friends could see this implication. That means that their creeds, that are human creeds, are not a part of the authority of Christ. They do nothing but cause division. They do nothing but create division, denominations. And they are the explanation for the confusion and the divided state of the religious world today. It's not the New Testament that causes that. It's what man has added to it to denominate and divide the religious world. And so what the basic principle here is that Christ is the supreme ruler, exercising his supreme authority through the New Testament, which is our only standard of authority. Now, I'd like for us to look quickly at page 8. This raises a question. What kind of organization? Christ, as supreme ruler, has given his church organization and government. So we look at the basic principle and see that he has given his church organization. So the supreme ruler has organized his own church. Now, the basic premise of this whole lesson that we need to keep in mind, and that other people who have not learned this need to learn, that it is necessary for the church today to maintain the organization that the Lord has put within his church in order to maintain its identity. If a church departs from the organization that the Lord has placed within the church, it has lost its identity as the Lord's church. So this is not, again, as we have emphasized about other things, some insignificant point, some unimportant matter. The organization is important to the distinct identity of the Lord's church. That's why we have included a lesson in this material, especially on this, because these principles right here are so important. Not only to our faith, our understanding of the church, making sure that the Lord's church maintains its identity where we are members, but also to be able to teach others that have departed from it in so many ways. So let's look at page 8 for just a moment. Be thinking if you have any questions or any comments, and we'll come to that part in just a moment. But let's look at some basic principles and lay a foundation for further study. Letter A. To identify the organization of the Lord's church, the distinction must be made between two uses of the word church. Number one, universal. And when we refer to the universal church, we simply refer to Christ's church as it consists of all who are saved. And the word occurs in this sense in several passages. I have several examples. In Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18, when the Lord said, I will build my church, he meant universally. Or in Ephesians chapter 5, when Paul referred to the church with the language that he did here to the church at Ephesus, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it, he was talking about the church universally. And likewise, in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 15, where he talked about the house of God, which we've already noted, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of truth. Well, that's referring to the universal church. Now, by contrast, number two, in some passages, the word church is used to refer to a local group, a local church. And by contrast, this is Christ's church as it consists of those who are members in a specific place. In contrast to the church everywhere, it is the church somewhere. It is the church in a specific geographical location. some examples there that I think probably most are familiar with. 1 Corinthians 1:2, the church of God which is at Corinth. See, that's referring to, Paul used the word ecclesia, at Corinth, that specific geographical location. Then Revelation chapter 1 and verse 4. In fact, the first three chapters of the book of Revelation identifies those to whom the book of Revelation was written. It was written to the seven churches of Asia. See, so in Asia there were seven churches to whom or to which the book of Revelation was written. And of course those churches are identified. In Romans chapter 16 and verse 16 is where Paul, in closing the Roman letter, said, "The churches of Christ salute you." The word churches, ecclesia, occurs in the plural form in that passage. Paul is referring to local churches sending salutation to the church at Rome. I'd like for us to turn to Acts chapter 11, verse 22. I heard these children the other night as Kent was asking them questions. He asked them a question, if I remember right, Kent. He said, "What is the church?" I believe that's the way that one of the questions is asked. And they answered it correctly. And when I hear the answer given, they said, "The people." And that's an important principle for those, even these young children are learning that, and that's important. But let's look at what this passage says. Acts chapter 11 and verse 22. If anyone ever disputes us, you hear someone say, "Well, it's time for us to put a new roof on the church." Say, wait a minute, let's look at how you've used the word church in that sense. Say, well, what's wrong with that? Well, let's read Acts 11, 22, and see how the Bible speaks. "And the report concerning them came to the ears of the church, which was in Jerusalem." That's all I wanted to read from that verse, because the church has ears. The New Testament identifies the word church, ecclesia, as having ears. And very clearly a passage that indicates the church is people, but he also uses it in a local sense. "To the ears of the church which is in Jerusalem." He wasn't talking about the church everywhere, he was talking about the church somewhere. So if we can learn, and I'll tell you, a lot of the literature I'm reading these days, some of our brethren are leaving this part out. There is less and less of an effort to make this a distinction between the church universal and the church local. It must be made. That's the way the New Testament presents it. But I tell you what happens when there's a failure to make the distinction, that a lot of the identity of the church is lost. Its work becomes vague. Exactly who is to do the work becomes confused. Let's continue with letter B. Why is it important? This distinction is important because Christ put organization in the church in only one of these two senses. You see, that's why it's important. And if you haven't learned that principle yet, if you're here tonight and studying these things perhaps at an early stage or for the first time, if you're visiting, this is an important principle to learn about the New Testament church. If you want to identify the New Testament church and depend only upon the teaching of Christ and set aside all teachings of human origin, then let's look at what the New Testament teaches. And what it teaches is that this distinction is important because when we look at the organization of the church, he put organization in only one of these two senses. And the two must not, perhaps that should have been underlined, must not be confused. They cannot be confused. Well, Numbers 1 and 2 under that explain this further. Christ has nothing whatsoever to say about organization in the universal sense. What that is teaching us, that the universal church has no organization. It doesn't. It's just not there. When we noted number one above, and we could see in passages where the word church is used in the universal sense in several passages. When we look at the church universal, there is no organization. It doesn't function as a unit. It doesn't function collectively. It doesn't assemble. And it doesn't work as a unit. Number two, Christ put organization only in the local church. It is in the church in the local sense that is to function as a unit, to carry out the mission that the Lord has given it to do, both in work and worship. Now, letter C. The organization put in place by Christ requires that certain conclusions be drawn, specific applications be made. Let's see what those are. This may stimulate some thought and question. Number one, as organized by Christ, each local church is an all-sufficient entity for doing the work He has given the church to do. There is nothing that the Lord has given to be done by His church that a local church cannot do. Everything that the Lord has given His, and we'll use the Payton City Church as an example. Everything that the Lord has given His church to do, this church can do. As it is. Number two, the local church is the only medium through which individual Christians can function to do the work assigned to the church. To be a faithful Christian, it is necessary to be a member of a local congregation. Let me give you another illustration of how important that principle is. We had two people come into our assembly there at Wheelersburg, Ohio. And I noticed them visiting, and I began to talk with them, an older couple. And it was their thinking, well, they were just kind of visiting around. They didn't really want to be a member of any particular congregation, so they were just kind of visiting. They would visit us a while, and they would visit another congregation a while. And I began to try to convince them that they needed to be members of a local church. Well, they didn't see the necessity of it. It wasn't long, however, with these principles and having further opportunity to teach these principles, our congregation has two more members, for they saw the importance of doing that, and they knew they could see where the only way that they as Christians, in order to be faithful, the only medium through which they could function in order to accomplish the work that the Lord had given the church to do is through a local church. And that's true. If I want to be a faithful Christian, I must be a faithful part of a local church and function with that local church to work and help it in the interest of the whole. I can't do that selfishly. I can't do that through selfish ambition. I can't do that. I must act. And we'll study these principles, I think, maybe tomorrow night as we look at other principles. But by putting forth my effort in the interest of the whole, the well-being of the whole body of Christ, and to build it up, to strengthen it, is my function as a faithful Christian. Let number three, any effort to mobilize individual Christians or local congregations, it doesn't matter, into a universal function is going beyond the organization the Lord has given His church. Now, you may see that and recognize that that has a lot of implication in referring to some things of the religious world today. Because what number three is talking about has been done in a lot of places. That is to mobilize local congregations into something larger than what they are as a local congregation. And as a result, we have intercongregational arrangements. We have sponsoring church arrangements. We'll say more about this at a later time. What I'm pointing out is there have been departures from this. There have been efforts to mobilize individual Christians and congregations into a universal, to whatever degree, larger than a local church, effort. What I'm going to do, I have a couple of charts. Let me kind of precede the charts with a few comments. I'm kind of going to challenge you a little bit, because these charts are going to present the universal church and the local church, but with something terribly wrong. Now, this is not kind of a test, but the diagram or the illustration, the graphic may not communicate, but we'll make sure it's understood. But I want you to look at this chart to see if you can identify anything wrong with the way it is. Let me put it on. look at it for just a moment. The little blue circles on the left represent Christians. The local church in green, the circles represent Christians. They're a little bigger. We're not trying to, you know, make them equal in size, but they're individual Christians. So, you see anything wrong with that chart? What, Gary? Say that again. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. See, if you looked at this chart, and I taught this chart tonight the way it is pictured, I would be teaching you that the universal church is made up of local churches. Do you believe that to be true? No. The universal church, remember, has no organization. The universal church is not made up of local churches. Now, what do I need to do to correct this chart? Well, it's very simple because I made it so that I could. Really, it's just to remove the circles. But that's all the universal church is, just individual Christians, wherever they may be, without organization. You see, if you're a Christian tonight, and let's say those of you here who are members of the Payton City Church, you are a member of the Church Universal. That means you have relationship to the Lord and to His Father, your Father. But also, if you're a member of this local church, you are a member of a local church that is an organization that functions collectively. And so you have relationship, but you're also a part of an organization. But so far as your part and your membership in the Church of Christ Universal, you're just an individual Christian with no organic ties, no organization that combines you with anyone else to do anything. You're just an individual Christian. But when you come to the local church, it's an entirely different matter. And that's why this distinction is so important. And so the universal church can be accurately represented this way, and the local church can be accurately represented this way. Some of the members of a local church will be functioning as elders. Some will be functioning as deacons. Some will be functioning as an evangelist. And all are members, some with a special work to do with greater responsibility. But that's a proper, I appreciate the recognition of that. Let me, maybe for further discussion, can anyone think of any further distinction between the universal church and the local church? Maybe that would be a good way to make some comments. I think if you haven't thought about this a while, it may be... Jay?
Unity is a great example of distinction between the local and universal church.
What was the word you used? I didn't...
Unity. Okay. Of which one did he become a member when he was baptized?
Yeah.
Obviously, the universal church. But it became his responsibility to identify with a local church.
Right.
So we're baptized automatically into the universal church.
Yeah.
But it becomes our individual responsibility to identify with a local church.
Right. That is a distinction that needs to be recognized and emphasized. And in fact, I had a chart with four things on it, and that's one of them here. Let me... I don't have the details under those, but if you want to kind of categorize differences between the local and universal church, you would do so. Let me start with number four, since that's what Jay was just referring to. The matter of entrance. When an individual is baptized into Christ, the Lord adds you to the church universally. But the way an individual becomes a member of a local church is like Saul attempted to do in Acts 9:31, essayed to join himself. And it is in that sense that we do join the church. that in that we have responsibility to join ourselves to a local group of people who are working and worshiping faithfully. So, entrance, number four. It's different. Universally, we're baptized into Christ. He adds us. He does that. We have nothing to do with that. But we must join ourselves to a local group. Okay. Let's say number. Can anyone bring out the point about number? What's the difference in number? Pardon? What, Jeff? Yeah. Right. Yeah, right. And the when you're talking about, like, sometimes maybe people are confused, we talk about there's one church. Unless, see, that's number. Well, in what sense is there just one church? Universally. But there are churches all over the world. In what sense? Locally, see. So there's one New Testament church. But there are churches. So you see that helps to explain, like Romans 16:16, the churches of Christ, in what sense? Plural. Local congregations. So there are a plurality of local churches, one universal church. Organization. We've already emphasized that, so let's reserve some time maybe on that. We've already emphasized the universal church has no organization. It's all in the local church. But composition. Composition, in effect, we've already alluded to that, but the universal church involves all the saved, and the local church just a local group of people who have agreed to work and worship together and function as a unit. Now here's a point that often maybe not be thought of. The universal church includes both those that are living and those that have passed away. The local church will not include in their number those that have been members who have died. But just because a person passes away doesn't mean that they're no longer in the Lord's church. They are. They're still in the saved in Christ, but in the universal sense. So the universal includes all, living and dead. The local church just includes, obviously, those of us who are living and functioning as the body of Christ. So maybe these things will help to stimulate thought and other further consideration in that subject. Any further comment or something that you'd like further clarified? We'll pause for just a moment. But, excuse me, Tom, start again. That is a recent example of a violation of these principles that we're talking about. Division in the brotherhood occurred many years ago when the Herald of Truth, as an expression probably most familiar with, came in, sponsoring church, World Radio, One Nation Under God, as Tom was referring to there, is a more recent violation of this principle. That's true. If something bigger is doing it, then we can just kind of give them the responsibility and let them do it. No. 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 No, just because some money is sent somewhere doesn't mean that the Lord's work is being done by those sending it, which is the basic principle of that. Good point. Let's look at page 9 further. This is the third page of this lesson. You see, as the preparer of these lessons went on, they tend to get longer, and he made no effort to edit. So the first two lessons were 2 pages. That was about 3 weeks ago. And then as the time drew closer, they just seemed to get longer. So we can look quickly, I believe, at page 9 in the time we have remaining. The point that we're looking at here is a further development of what we've just studied. The organization of the local church consists of an established order which makes each one independent and self-governing. Well, we ask, well, what about the organization that the supreme ruler has placed within his church? Well, it has an established order that makes each one independent and self-governing. This is oftentimes called the autonomy of the local church. So if that's a term that you're familiar with, the autonomy of the local church, that's what this is talking about. Autonomy just simply means, that word from the Greek means self-rule. So anything that is autonomous means self-ruled. So the principle on this, how do we know that this is true? Well, at letter A, this established order is seen in that in each local church, the Lord has put a plurality of elders who are to oversee the church, and deacons who are to serve as special servants. The qualifications of deacons are found in 1 Timothy 3, 8 through 13, and Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1. Paul salutes the church at Philippi with those that are bishops and deacons. So that's the established order so far as these officers are concerned. At Numbers 1 and 2, we have information about elders, which I'm sure most are familiar with. But just to look at those principles briefly, elders and bishops are one and the same. The word bishop means overseer or superintendent, and they are to rule the church or to oversee the church. It is the responsibility of the elders to exercise the oversight. That's a quote from 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 2. To function as pastors or shepherds. The word pastor occurs in Ephesians chapter 4 verse 11 because of the influence of the Latin language. That's where that term came from. The Greek word poimeon is translated more literally in our language, shepherd. That's what the word means. And it is the elders or the bishops that are the pastors or shepherds with the responsibility to watch in behalf of souls as shepherds overseeing the flock. But an important point that we've noted, the authority of elders extends only to executing the laws which Christ made. He is the one who has vested within him all authority, legislative authority, executive authority, and judicial authority. And so therefore, the function of elders is simply to carry out the will of the Lord as their chief shepherd, as our chief shepherd. Letter B, here is the heart of this principle, that each church is independent and self-governing can be seen from the limitations that are placed upon the ruling officers. And the way that that is seen is in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 2, where the Apostle Peter, given these instructions to the elders in this passage, made this familiar statement as he gave the instruction in verse 2. Tend the flock of God, which is among you, exercising the oversight. So now if we applied that to this chart, this chart here, see that we have a local church here, this right here, and we have those that are elders, and this instruction given to those individuals tells them, according to the authority of the Lord, to exercise the oversight, to tend the flock of God which is among you. So that's pretty plain, and that's pretty simple. So that means that their authority to oversee is only over the church which has appointed them elders. Their authority does not extend beyond that. Think, well, that's simple, yeah, but there's a lot of violations of that principle today. Elders of one congregation overseeing another church. Hear that quite often. That's simply a violation of New Testament teaching. And further, number two, if everybody's following in the material, under letter B, Christ's church has no earthly headquarters, and neither does it have an organizational structure whereby several local churches are ruled by a hierarchy. A body of ruling persons. Such things, as we've mentioned, as human councils, synods, conventions, are not a part of the organization of Christ's church, such as foreign to the Scriptures. I mentioned in the introduction of this lesson, I might make reference back to that. If you look at page 7 up in the introduction, it's a quote from an individual that was converted from a denominational church. He made the statement, and I think it's significant to our study, the organization of the church is the strongest argument that can be made against denominationalism. That's an observation of a person who was a part of denominationalism, began to study these things that we're talking about tonight and learned the truth. And as far as this individual is concerned, this is the thing that made the difference. Because the church of which he and others like him were a part had an earthly headquarters that told them what to do, that ruled over them. And the organization of the church as presented in the New Testament is so clear and so simple that if people are going to be, it will be honest enough to learn that, then that is very, very effective in helping people who are a part of human religions and organizations that have been developed to learn the truth. Well, let's get the conclusions in before our time is up. Letter C at the bottom of page 9. And these are kind of self-explanatory now that we have already made these statements. These principles lead us to make the following conclusions. Each local church is responsible for itself. Well, what do you mean? Well, to appoint its own elders, hire its own preacher, have its own treasury, manage its own spending, discipline its own members, and oversee and do its own work. There's no one else has authority to come and tell you and rule over you on doing any of those things that it is your distinct responsibility to do. And by the same token, neither is it your responsibility or prerogative to do that to anyone else. Number two, two or more churches cannot form any kind of arrangement that would combine them into an organization larger than what each of them is alone. Now, we've heard of two small, weak churches, maybe, in a general area where their works may have declined, and they decided, well, hey, we'd be stronger if we'd get together. And that sometimes happens. But that's not what this is talking about, because what they do is combine themselves into one local church. What we're talking about here is into an organization that is larger than an organization of the local church. We're talking about intercongregational organizations and alliances and so forth that we hear a lot about. And so that we are not permitted to combine into an organization larger than what each local church is on its own with a distinct organization that the Lord has given it. I know that there's a lot that could be said about the organization of the church, a lot more. We've said a lot tonight, but certainly a lot more can be said. But hopefully we've established some of the basic principles. And my ear has not picked up the first buzzer, but the time says it has rung. Is that true? He's punctual. It's about 8:21, so we maybe have about 3 minutes. Our time goes quickly. At least it does for me. I don't know about you, but it goes quickly, and we'll stop. Maybe there's some comments and questions that feel free to make.